The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
And welcome aboard, everybody. Jay Oliver here, another edition of Ask the Medical Expert. As far as Peconic Bay Medical Center is concerned, as we focus in on some of the very important categories of the PBMC of what you need to know with us today, Jay Oliver here. Great to be aboard. Ram Johnanet. Dr. Johnanet is a board certified physician in cardiology and does some great things over at PBMC. He is our center of attention here on a Saturday afternoon. Doctor, how are you?
Good morning, Jay. I'm great. How are you doing?
It is great to have you aboard here in the world of cardiology, such an important category as far as everything is concerned. Cardiac, I'm going to pronounce it, taking a chance, electrophysiology and internal medicine. And let's get right into it as far as heart health. We know how important it is, sir. The aspect of heart health. Does the medical field of cardiac electrophysiologist, as far as the studying of all, what does it encompass?
Yeah. Well, first, before we get right into it, I want to let everyone know February is Heart Month, and I want to express gratitude to all the healthcare providers, whether they're doctors, nurses, dietitians, and everyone else that are involved in keeping our hearts healthy, especially here in Long Island and in the eastern region of Long Island, especially as well. In terms of cardiac electrophysiology, it's a very sort of unknown field in many ways, and a lot of patients who come to us don't know why they're coming. We're basically a subspecialty of cardiology, and it deals with this very complex system in the heart, of the electrical system of the heart, which controls how the heart beats. And as you know, the heart beats in a particular way, and if it's offbeat, we don't feel well. So electrophysiology treats and diagnoses all these different problems with the heartbeat itself.
No question. Very important, no doubt about it. So give me a little bit as far as the disorders that are concerned. What are the most common types of heart rhythm disorders?
Yeah. First, to understand the heart rhythm disorders, we have to understand the basic anatomy of the heart. And I make it very simple. As we all know from school, and the heart has the four chambers. The top chamber is called the atrium, and the bottom chamber is called the ventricle. So heart rhythm disorders could come from either the top chamber or the bottom chamber. And depends on where they're coming from, they have different level of seriousness. So they're generally classified as either a fast heartbeat, which sometimes could be perceived as a more serious type of heartbeat problem, or sometimes they could be a slow heartbeat. Our heart, as we all know, should operate, it varies by age and your body type, but generally operates between a heart rate of about, say, 50 to 100, and heartbeats outside that range are considered heart rhythm disorders. And again, they could be either fast or slow. And we could subdivide them whether they are short duration, meaning a second or less, or if they last longer, more than 5-10 seconds, becomes much longer.
All right. And, you know, we hear a lot. I mean, the most common type, at least of one of my indicators, is AFib, right? I mean, atrial fibrillation. Explain a little bit about AFib, and especially we always hear it pertaining to stroke. I think a lot of people are somewhat confused about the correlation, but let's go into AFib because we know a lot of people. I know a lot of people in my family. People have suffered from AFib and have to be monitored in a very big way. And also, it's interesting how sleep apnea played a role into that, if you can kind of diagnose those three things.
Absolutely. When I started in the field, atrial fibrillation was considered a disease of mainly older people. Today, that's not true for a variety of reasons. From the very young, typically late 30s, to older people can experience what's called atrial fibrillation. To understand what atrial fibrillation is to simply understand what a heartbeat is. The heartbeat starts from one area in the heart, usually the top right-hand side, upper chamber, the right atrium, and it spreads through the rest of the heart like a beautiful wave in a very nice wave-like manner across the heart. And that causes what we call synchronous contraction. of the top chamber, the atria, which then leads to synchronous contraction of the bottom chamber, the ventricles, which their main function is to pump blood to the rest of the body. So this synchronization of top and bottom chambers is what makes us feel so healthy and makes the blood flow really well. When you develop atrial fibrillation, what happens is instead of the heartbeat starting from that one area that I described, you have electrical impulses that are very disorganized, that originate from multitude of areas in the top chamber. So as a result, you have multiple sparks, so to speak, and that causes what we call dyssynchronous contraction of the chamber, of the top chamber. That transmits to the bottom chamber and leads to dyssynchronous contraction of the bottom chamber. As a result, your blood flow is like a heart, is like a car engine that's not pumping well and shuts off, restarts, vibrates hard, vibrates low. And that's what happens to the heart. As a result of that, a number of things happen. When the blood doesn't flow well, blood has the ability to coagulate or form blood clots. The formation of blood clots could then lead to strokes. These clots are sent through the aorta to the brain and other parts of the body. And it could cause stroke, it could cause blood clots elsewhere in the body, such as blood clots, for example, in the kidneys, leading to kidney problems. So atrial fibrillation can be viewed as the heart really going crazy with its electrical impulses coming from many scattered locations. Now, you mentioned the concept of sleep apnea. Sleep apnea, when I first started medicine many decades ago, sleep apnea was thought to be only in patients who were extremely obese. So the bulk of the population, in our mind, did not have sleep apnea. Today, we have learned quite the opposite. Even the most healthy and fit people could have sleep apnea. Now, it's based on anatomy of the muscles in the oral cavity and the breathing apparatus. And some of these muscles get very relaxed. Sometimes they are a little bit thickened, get very relaxed, and they collapse when we sleep. And we don't get good flow of air, and we deprive our body of oxygen, and then that leads to heart rhythm conditions based on the deprivation of oxygen and increased pressure in the thoracic cavity. Now, the diagnosis of sleep apnea is a little bit difficult at times. It requires one getting a sleep study. In the not-so-long-ago past, one had to sleep overnight in a facility overnight to get a good-quality sleep study to diagnose whether they had sleep apnea or not. Today, we could send a monitor to the patient home. They hook it up themselves, and usually for 3 hours, we get the results back, and we tell if they have sleep apnea or not. They will report how many episodes per hour of where they stop breathing, and that's important in the diagnosis of sleep apnea. Now, I'd like to point out a few things. Most people who have sleep apnea, they snore, but not everyone that snores has sleep apnea. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing is there's a lot of data that shows that sleep apnea clearly is one of the main contributors for atrial fibrillation, but it also causes other problems such as decrease in memory, increased stroke risk, high blood pressure, weight gain, stress, anxiety, decreased metabolism, and the list goes on. So, but as it relates to sleep apnea and stroke, the correlation is clearly there to the point where almost every patient that I see with atrial fibrillation, regardless of age, I ask the important question, do they have sleep apnea or not? We do a rough screening in the office to tell if they have it, and if we have a reasonable suspicion they have sleep apnea, we would send them for the sleep study.
Very important. I tell you, I know a lot of family members with that, Doc, and very important. You know, you can't, you know, it's something I've learned that you can't ignore.
Absolutely not.
And I know people in the medical field, by the way, who have ignored that. My own family members. So it is vital to take ownership of it and get checked, right? And that's the key.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me add one more thing to the sleep apnea, because even though I'm not a sleep specialist, I'm very involved in it, because I really feel, based on everything you're saying, people feel so much better. The major impediment for both physicians and patients who are very educated and smart ignoring it is they've already jumped ahead to the treatment. They said, Doc, there's no way I'm going to wear that mask or that thing on my face. And I tell them, listen, pick your poison. Either you're going to try to wear it and we're going to work with it, or you're going to develop major health problems later in life. And the good news is some of the new masks and cannulas and those kind of things we are giving them, you know, are easier to wear, and they tolerate it better. In the old days, I agree, the masks were huge, and they occupy most of the face, and it was looked hideous. Today, they have much nicer masks, half masks, nasal cannulas, those type of things that are much more tolerable. And what I tell people is, listen, at least make the diagnosis. Let's forget the treatment for a second. Let's know if you have it or not. And you know what the most important treatment is for sleep apnea? Very simple. Weight loss, weight loss, weight loss. So, you know, I would say 50% of people who have sleep apnea, when they undergo significant weight loss, their sleep apnea will get better. There's also this field of exercise, oral exercises, which an ENT physician or a dentist could explain a little bit better.
Doc, I'm going to ask you to I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We got to take our first break and only break of the segment. We will return important conversations, folks, regarding good heart health. We're in that month. We'll be back right after this. They have it all covered, and we talk to experts every week, and we got a great one today, Dr. Ram Jadinet. He's board certified in cardiology for PBMC. We're talking, and it's very appropriate. Why? February is good heart month, heart healthy type situations involved that we need to think about here in the month of February. And we're talking about a plethora of activity with the biggest muscle in the human body, and that is the heart. And the heart is pretty much centered around life when you think about it. Without it, we don't have life. Dr. Jadinet, if you could pick up where we left off, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. So we covered a very important topic of sleep apnea, which, again, even though it's something relating to the brain and the lungs, really truly affects the heart. And we were talking about the treatment options to give your listeners some encouragement in terms of going to get a diagnosis, because the treatment isn't as bad as they sometimes think. So weight loss is very important in terms of the treatment. As I said, 50% of people could improve if they have sleep apnea. How much you eat and how late you eat is very important for a lot of different conditions in terms of health. The general rule of thumb, if you could adhere to it, is not to eat late, meaning, you know, give yourself at least 4 hours of digestion before you go to bed. And if you had to go to bed a little bit sooner, do some activities to walk it off. And then to avoid or minimize alcohol as much as you can, especially late in the evening before you go to bed. This habit of having a glass of wine and then go to bed, you are inviting sleep apnea to occur, even in someone who does not have sleep apnea, because alcohol is a great relaxant, and it relaxes the muscles involved with respiration, and that's what induces sleep apnea in some people. So I'm glad you brought up the sleep apnea as it relates to atrial fibrillation. We screen all of our patients today before we even consider other types of treatment.
That is a big-time component of this, without a question. Even I know that. I'm glad we're talking about it. And people really need to know about it, you know, because AFib is such a common occurrence right now. But there are some preventative measures. You just gave a great one right there. Everybody said, yeah, have a glass of wine to relax you and go to bed. Not the case, according to the good doctor here. He said that's the worst thing you could do, and you're only inviting trouble. So I think that's a very important part of our conversation this morning here. What about, I keep hearing, you know, I've heard a term before, maybe you can help me out here, Doc, cardiac ablation. And why do people have this procedure? And what can they expect, if you can go over that?
Yeah. So ablation, from an English perspective, means to get rid of stuff, okay? In this case, we get rid of small amount of tissue, if I could describe it that way, that generates these abnormal electrical pulses in the heart. The amount of tissue gain is sometimes microscopic. So the important question that almost every patient asks me, Doc, you're going to do an ablation to me, are you going to damage my heart muscle? The answer is generally no, because the amount of tissue we're eliminating from the ablation procedure is very, very small amount, which amounts to some a bunch of bad cells that are triggering these abnormal heartbeat. So in order to do the ablation procedure, we have to have entrance in the heart. So we typically will go from the groin area, we enter a vessel called the femoral vein, which is very easy to enter. It's like putting an intravenous line in your hand. So you go to the emergency room, you need an intravenous line, they place it in your veins in the hand or the forearm. Similarly, we are able to enter this vein very easily. And from the entrance, we are able to insert what's called catheters. These are very, very small, flimsy wires coated with special soft coating, polyurethane-type material, which is very sturdy and it doesn't shed into the body. We insert these things under guidance of x-rays or ultrasounds up to the heart. We know exactly where to put them. They're very easy to put in the heart. We then are able to localize or map out the electrical system in the heart, and we know what a normal system looks like. And then we're able to trigger these abnormal heartbeats and then pinpoint them with pinpoint precision. And once we pinpoint it, we put the tip of the catheter on top of the bad spot. And then through the catheter, we deliver what's called energy. The energy could be in different forms. It could be in the form of heat energy, which you don't feel. It's radio waves, which is a frequency below microwave. You put your food in the microwave and it heats up. So we put microwave through the catheter. It heats up the tip of the catheter, just that tip itself, not the whole catheter. And that desiccates or destroys the cell. And that prevents the bad heartbeat or the arrhythmia or the heart rhythm disturbance from occurring. There are other forms of energy we use. It depends on the type of heartbeat problem you have. Sometimes we will use what's called cold energy, which is freezing energy. It's called cryoablation. And it's hooked up to a machine that generates cold energy, makes the tip of the catheter get cold, and the cold spot on top of the area that's bad, again, destroys those cells. So those are the two main forms of ablation. The procedure generally depends on the type you have. It could take less than an hour to sometimes a few hours. Generally, the patient is put under light anesthesia for the most part. Sometimes the anesthesia is a little bit heavier. When they finish end of the procedure, they're fully awake. They're in the recovery room. A lot of patients stay overnight, but we're starting to send more and more patients home. By the second day when they go home, they're pretty much able to resume most activities. And depends on the type of arrhythmia we're dealing with. We see cure rates for most of these arrhythmias, 95% to 99% cure rates. There are some types, like atrial fibrillation, unfortunately, has a slightly lower cure rate of about 70% to 80%. Now, the reason why atrial fibrillation ablation has a lower cure rate than other types is because AFib, or atrial fibrillation, starts from multiple locations, and you have to get all those spots. And sometimes that can be challenging, especially when they're coming pretty deep or in areas where it's a little bit difficult to get to. So all in all, these are very successful procedures, and the complication rate from these procedures at most centers are truly less than 1%. And usually when a complication occurs, it tends not to be of the serious nature.
There you go. Important there. Dr. Ram Jenner with us. We're talking cardiology. It is Heart Health Awareness Month in the month of February, folks. And it's a good month and a good time to really kind of concentrate on yourself, your health. With all that's been going on pandemic-wise. And, Doc, that's another thing. You know, we're in this pandemic. A lot of people kind of sidestep this stuff. You know, they're so focused on COVID and everything else. You know what? Life goes on and your health goes on. And that's why you need to get checked, right?
Absolutely. So in this pandemic, you're quite correct. First of all, if you are unlucky to contract COVID, whether you got sick or not from it, you need to be screened eventually by your cardiologist or your internist, because some of these heart rhythm conditions we're seeing could develop from it, even the patients who had, quote, asymptomatic COVID. So you should make it a point of seeing your physician. Mm. And have them at least do an EKG on you to determine if you develop any problems as a result of the COVID. That's important. And the other advice I could give your listeners, especially since we're all this COVID pandemic and have this COVID fatigue, whether you're a healthcare worker or not a healthcare worker, it doesn't matter. We all have it. The things I could tell people is make sure that we, at this point, pay particular attention to eating right. Take an inventory of what you're eating. And let's get rid of the stuff you really don't need or it's not going to do you good. All right? Let's make sure we're sleeping right. And sleep right, listen, for very, very busy people in all walks of life, all different professions, we sometimes have to limit our sleep time because we have to get to work. But in general, we should all remind ourselves we need 7 hours of sleep, of good sleep. And we should try to get 7 hours of sleep. We need to all start exercising right. And this concept of going to a gym and say, I'm going to pump 400 pounds of iron is not exercise. That's hurting the body. Good exercise from a cardiologist standpoint is low to moderate intensity with frequency. Frequency means at least 3 to 4 times a week of a half hour of low to moderate intensity exercise. You want to have good heart health, you start doing that. Even when you have conditions, they will become reversible. Stress reduction. We all talk in society about stress reduction. But I think all of us are guilty of stressing over things we don't need to stress about.
Yeah, Doc, it's great advice. It really is. We're running out of time. Yeah. You know, I want to have you on again. I mean, the information is vital. Can't thank you enough, though, right? We'll have a return visit with you, I hope. Dr. Ramjanina, he's board certified in cardiology, cardiac, electrophysiology, and internal medicine at the PBMC. Thanks so much, Doc. Great advice.
Thank you, Jay.
Good stuff.
Pleasure to be on. Yep. Thank you.
We'll talk to you again. No question. Jay Oliver here. We'll see you next week, ladies and gentlemen. Another round of it.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.